and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Trump administration over the past several days has tried to defend itself against allegations that it has lost track of 1,500 undocumented children placed in temporary care. The accusations come on the heels of news reports that the Department of Homeland Security has implemented a policy of separating undocumented parents from their children. But the truth is that the policy dates from the Obama administration, and at this point in his presidency, Obama deported far more people than Trump has. Next, Italy's current political situation is in a state of chaos. Just days after two populist parties, the Five Star Movement and the far-right League Party, agreed to form a new government, the deal fell apart and President Sergio Mattarella has called for new elections. The two parties are expected to win even more seats in the next parliament. Then, Colombians have failed to elect a president outright, setting the stage for a bitter runoff between two frontrunners from opposite ends of the political spectrum, while a fragile peace process with leftist former rebels hangs in the balance. And then, electronic incarceration, the use of ankle bracelets and other monitoring devices on released prisoners, are popular government alternatives to prison. But are they really that different? The devices have turned prisoners' homes into prisons. In addition, prisoners are charged a daily fee for electronic incarceration, and if they can't pay for it, they go right back. And finally, Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health released a study this morning saying that the government's estimate of 64 deaths in Puerto Rico from last year's Hurricane Maria grossly underestimated the true number. The report puts the number of deaths at over 4,600, many of them because of delayed medical care. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the border. The Trump administration over the past several days has tried to defend itself against allegations that it has lost track of 1,500 undocumented children placed in temporary care. The accusations come on the heels of news reports that the Department of Homeland Security has implemented a policy of separating undocumented parents from their children. But the truth is that the policy dates from the Obama administration. And at this point in his presidency, Obama deported far more people than Trump has. We're joined from Colombia by Ajamu Baraka. He's a longtime human rights activist, organizer, and political activist. And he was the 2016 Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. Ajamu, always great to have you.
It's my pleasure to be able to join you once again. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to start with something that you posted on Facebook recently that is just so powerful. I think that everybody needs to hear it. And this is what you said. I come on Facebook and it seems like people have gone absolutely mad. Before Trump, the U.S. was just a paradise. Kids weren't being separated from their parents at the border. The U.S. was not bombing seven nations, supporting a genocide war in Yemen, giving uncritical support to Israeli apartheid. Black and brown folks were not being murdered with impunity by the police. People had plenty of high-paying jobs with benefits. Everyone had access to health care, and mass incarceration never happened. Madness. Liberal, right-wing, neoliberal madness. And it's all true. This is not a new policy. This isn't something that ought to be shocking to us now. It should have been shocking to us years ago when it was implemented by the Obama administration.
John, you're exactly right, and that's really the thrust of my comment is really geared toward those activists who I think should know better, who have used precious resources and energy to target the Trump administration, which. Well, of course, we should, but they are propping up a narrative that seems to suggest that this Trump administration is some kind of profound departure from the politics of neoliberalism that's been in command for the last few decades. And the kinds of systematic abuses of individual and collective human rights that we saw under every administration is now a distant memory and is all about Trump. So my suggestion is that if we're serious about real social change in this country, we're serious about trying to reverse the ideological inroads made by the radical right, we've got to have clear politics, and we've got to rid our discourse from these sort of liberal myths.
Yeah, it is actually a myth. You know, you go on to say, and you say it in such plain English. I wish I had thought of it to say it myself. You say, is this deliberate propaganda to pretend that all of this started with Trump? Or is it that folks just didn't realize how brutal the Obama administration's policies were with the families and children from Central America? Stop spreading Democrat Party propaganda. Both of those parties are anti-working class, pro-imperialist, bourgeois parties. Deal with that reality and understand the terms of today's struggle. That's really what it comes down to, isn't it? They're just two versions of the same policy.
It really is. And I'm sorry I cut you off. I forgot about my own comment. I thought that I had gotten to the end of it. But that is basically the message that, again, we have a responsibility, those of us who should know better, to keep the focus on the kind of on developing the kind of critical consciousness that needs to be developed for us to be able to confront the internal contradictions of this system and not get caught up in the personality conflicts and the diversionary politics of the anti-Trumpism. I want us to be clear about our positions, understanding that we are in a long-term fight, and we are not serious about putting out politics that are clear, that are going to help people to understand critically how this society is organized, what the interests of this particular state, and what we need to do in order to advance a more progressive a vision for this society, then we are doing a disservice to ourselves and for all those who are coming after us. So we've got to be clear, in my opinion. And this situation with what's happening up on the border and the separation of these children from their families is, I think, a clear example of the kind of madness that has taken hold in the consciousness among so many people in this country.
There are developments. I agree. I completely agree with your point, Ajamu. And I think it's the most important point to make. Specifically, though, there are increases in deportations for some parts of the population that are going on. And one of the things, too, about the kids, I think the picture that we took, we saw those terrible pictures that were in the Arizona Central media of children locked in cages, basically. Some of those pictures actually came earlier, like during the Obama administration, I believe. And the Obama administration went to court successfully to argue that children who have been separated from their parents and detained should not have court-appointed attorneys. A lot of people don't remember that, but even one of the arguments was a three-year-old shouldn't have a court-appointed attorney. I mean, just ridiculous. But in the last year, there has been a big increase in the number of deportations to Haiti. It was about 300 in 2016, the last year of Obama, about 5,500 last year in 2017 of Haitians who were deported. The Haitians, 50,000 Haitians and almost a similar number of people from El Salvador have also lost temporary protective status. That was given to Haitians who came here during the earthquake, the terrible earthquake. So, and the other thing that is new is the language of the Trump administration. You see John Kelly and Sessions saying, no big deal, I'm paraphrasing, no big deal about separating children from their parents, as John Kelly said, because, of course, those kids can go into foster care or whatever, as he said. So it's this kind of brazen, explicit, xenophobic, racist statements from the Trump administration accompanying these racist policies. Maybe the policies haven't changed so much, although they have to some degree, but the explicitness of the white supremacy, the explicitness of the racism is a little bit different. Go ahead.
Well, I think you're right, Brian, in terms of that factor, that the Republicans, unlike the Democrats, don't feel any need to sugarcoat white supremacist policies. You know, as someone who's been involved in this issue for quite some time as a human rights worker, I remember quite clear the battles we had with the Clinton administration in the 1990s around this same issue. And at that point, it was also Haitians, but it was Haitians, you know, primarily in places like a Chrome Detention Center in Florida who were being separated from their children. So, you know, the brazen racism may be different, but as you said in your comment and question, the policies have been somewhat consistent. I mean, it's unfortunate that the Haitians have lost temporary protective status. But again, I remember the battles we had with the new Obama administration. Well, we were, as soon as he came into power, into office, we were agitating with others to extend temporary protective status. The administration hesitated. And, you know, it was a lot of confusion internally among the progressives around whether or not we should continue to push or whatever. But the point is this: it wasn't really until the earthquake that they extended temporary protective status. So all the Trump folks did was to allow that status to eclipse with Haitians and with the folks from El Salvador. But again, the policies of the U.S. in attempting to try to filter the process of immigration from those nations that are being ravaged by neoliberal policies remains the same kind of racist, backward policies.
We're speaking with Ajamu Baraka. He joins us from Colombia. He's the national organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace and a longtime human rights activist, organizer, and political activist. And he was also the 2016 Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. Ajamu, where do we go from here? This this hideous policy has gotten a lot of press. There appears to be public outrage. I'm not really hearing anything from Capitol Hill, though. Are we, should we, I should say, expect any changes?
I think that we have there's a possibility now of at least raising people's awareness of these inhumane conditions on the border. But it seems to me that one of the interesting contradictions of the Democratic Party politics is that even the Democratic representatives aren't being too vocal because I don't think they want the connections to be made between the current implementation of these policies and the policies of the previous administration. And, you know, to be quite frank, both parties have been negligent in terms of addressing the issues of the lack of any kind of coherent immigration policy and the move toward providing some kind of regularized status for people who are undocumented. And this issue of undocumented workers coming across the border is a wedge issue that has an impact on not just Republicans, but also those blue dog Democrats. So it's unfortunate that unless there is more pressure coming from the bottom up, connecting the plight of these migrant workers, for the most part, with the larger working class movement and issues, we're not going to see much movement on this issue, in my opinion.
That's the imperative need, right, John?
It is. We're out of time. We were joined from Colombia by Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu is the national organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace and a longtime human rights activist, organizer, and political activist. And he was the 2016 Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Italy's current political situation is in a state of chaos. Just days after two populist parties, the Five Star Movement and the far-right League Party, agreed to form a new government, the deal fell apart and President Sergio Mattarella has called for new elections. The two parties are expected to win even more seats in the next parliament. We're joined from Edinburgh, Scotland by John White. He's the host of the weekly Sputnik radio show Hard Facts. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, guys. Good to be back with you again.
Happy to be here.
John, let's start with you. What do we make of this? It just seems like there's this incredible surge of populism in Western Europe, possibly even threatening Italian participation in the Eurozone. How bad is this going to get?
Well, we're looking at the advanced stages of the ongoing crisis of neoliberalism, and like King Canute, the EU political establishment, pro-EU political establishment, refuses to accept that the answer to this crisis of neoliberalism is not more neoliberalism in the form of asphyxiating austerity programs, And indeed, this requires a significant investment on the part of governments in order to start to grow their way out of the economic crisis that was wrought originally in 2008 with the global financial crash, leading to the worst global recession since the 1930s. But unfortunately, this pro-EU establishment is ideologically wedded to this broken, and I would suggest dead, neoliberal economic model. In this regard, they call to mind the sage words of Karl Marx when he said, and I quote, "They are like sorcerers who are no longer able to control the powers of the netherworld they have called up by their spells." And unfortunately, for me being on the left, the beneficiaries of this crisis are the populist right. We saw this with Brexit in the UK in 2016. We've seen this with the advance of Front National in France, far-right populist parties in Holland, and the Eurosceptic Hungarian government led by Orban. And obviously, we've seen it, how it's catalyzed the movement for Catalan separatism last year from Spain. And now in Italy, with the advance of this populist right-wing coalition, which is Eurosceptic and fiercely anti-migrant. And Mr. Mattarelli, with his unconscionable decision to veto the proposed appointment of Paolo Salvona of the, I believe, of the Northern League as the finance minister, because he dared to establish a plan B should Italy need to leave the Eurozone, has now gifted the far right, I would suggest, a massive majority when the next elections take place, which is muted to be by the end of the summer.
Yeah, Walter, John White is right. The president, Sergio Mattarella, who said that this government will not be allowed to stand because of the right-wing policies of the proposed economic minister or finance minister, it is a gift to the ultra-right. And I think it's important for people to understand the rise of the right and the rise of fascism generally. And I'm not saying Italy is about to go fascist. That's not my point. But the right is going to get stronger right now. It's not simply like an arithmetic equation, how many people are left and how many people are right. It's a struggle. It's a dynamic struggle. It's a dialectical struggle. You take the case of Germany or Italy before the rise of Hitlerism in Germany or Mussolini in Italy. They had huge, giant socialist and communist movements. And public opinion, say, in Germany was the most left-wing and enlightened public opinion anywhere in the world. And yet the fascists could win out, partly as a consequence of inconsistencies or contradictions within the left. And right now we see in the case of Italy that the left, the old left, the left that was so historically dominant, it's no more. And so there's a sort of rudderlessness for the left. And as a consequence, the right is poised again to take advantage. Or am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right. The question is, who has a way out of the crisis? I mean, Italy's been subjected to like John White was saying, you know, suffocating austerity since the beginning of the Eurozone crisis, you know, shortly following the 2008-2009 world financial collapse. And so, you know, the Italian working class, which, as you point out, has been historically organized in the socialist communist movement, you know, have been deprived of what, you know, historically is their natural leadership, the leadership of the left, because of, you know, certain developments that took place after the end of the Cold War. And, you know, I think there's one other important thing that this illustrates is that, you know, there's this idea out there that the far left and the far right are just two sides of the same coin, and really they're fundamentally the same at the end of the day. And it's up to, you know, the enlightened center to save society. You know, what happened in Italy shows that it's exactly the opposite. The thing that's fueling the growth of the far right is not, you know, the far left, right? It's not just the rise of the extremes generally. It's the absolute refusal of the, you know, the traditional ruling elite to give any type of concession, any type of progressive concession to poor and working people. And so, you know, Mattarella, the Italian president, refusing to, you know, seat this government on the basis of this finance minister that the credit rating agencies would find objectionable, that is going to lead to a huge boost in the vote for the Northern League, or for the League Party, the far right National Front, Marine Le Pen style party in Italy. And so it's the intransigence of the traditional elite rulers that fuels the rise of these far right semi-fascist movements.
John White, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up something that you said, Brian, because I think it's hugely important to when we try to get a grip on this, this situation and this crisis. There are, of course, objective factors and subjective factors responsible for the rise of the far right. And the objective factors, I contend, is the lack of the adaptation of the left to the deindustrialization of Western economies throughout the 80s, 90s and onwards. We're also still suffering the grievous consequences of the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, where social democracy was pitched to the right and no longer had to parcel out reforms to working people because the threat of an alternative economic and social model was no longer present. And I have to say that not the whole left, but a large enough section of the left, I think, moved towards an identity politics model as a surrogate for class. And this left a massive vacuum within working class communities, especially low income communities. And that vacuum has been filled by the right. And we've seen we see the culmination of this on the back of this crisis of neoliberalism that erupted in 2008. And they are wreaking devastating results because they wear the garb of class politics, as you know, the history of fascism leaves no doubt. And this is more akin to the 1930s, the early 1930s or the late 1920s, when the rise of the right started to take place. And there was seemingly no answer to it because the centre ground had collapsed. As I said, I used Marx's quote to describe the idiocy and the contradictions in there, and they're holding fast to this dead, ideologically dead economic model. And the left, I'm afraid, is largely absent. So there needs to be a realignment of the left on a pan-Europe basis, I would contend, that stands shoulder to shoulder with migrants. Italy doesn't need a government that wants to deport 500,000 immigrants. It needs a government that wants to deport bankers and global corporations. And that's the difference, the essential difference between a left-wing stance and a left-wing response to the global economic crash and the contradictions within neoliberalism and a right-wing response.
Walter, let's keep going on this theme. These are important issues. And of course, we only have about 2 minutes left. But, you know, the right, the ultra-right is also, I would say, not exclusively, but extensively based on, quote, identity politics, because you have the Northern League now renamed. It's really about what it means to be an Italian. It really is about hostility towards immigrants and towards migrants. And of course, Italy and Greece and Turkey, the Mediterranean countries, have had a large migration of people from Northern Africa or the Middle East or South Asia because of their physical proximity. But it's all about identity, meaning we are Italians, rather than a left approach where you're promoting not only working class sort of unity, but also international solidarity between workers and peoples of different lands.
Yeah, and that's how you know it's fundamentally a scam, the position of the right wing, right? I mean, they can talk about all they want about how, you know, all Italians are unified and, you know, one people, and by which they mean white Italians. But, you know, at the end of the day, Italian bankers, Italian corporate CEOs, Italian corporate executives, they don't have the same interests as, you know, Italian working class people, Italian people who have been unemployed for years and years and years, or semi-employed because of the economic crisis caused by those very same bankers. You know, it's clear, and this is something that, you know, the left has, of course, been pointing out for, you know, the entirety of its existence as a political movement, that the interests of the people in the various countries of the world who are laborers, who have to work for a living, have more in common with each other than for the elites who want to swindle them into thinking that they have something in common.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from Edinburgh, Scotland by John White. John's the host of the weekly Sputnik radio show Hard Facts, and we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Colombians have failed to elect a president outright, setting the stage for a bitter runoff between two frontrunners from opposite ends of the political spectrum, while a fragile peace process with leftist former rebels hangs in the balance. We're joined from New York by Mario Murillo. He's professor of communications and Latin American studies at Hofstra University, and he's covered Colombia for over 25 years. He's the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Mario, it's always great to have you.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
I have to say that I'm a little bit surprised by how much coverage this election is getting in the mainstream media. It's a very hard-fought election. Tell us how things are going in Colombia.
Well, I think the elections in many ways were predicted by a lot of the polls, the public opinion polls leading up to the vote on Sunday. I think the one surprising thing perhaps is the fact that there is an indication that the country is tired of war and conflict. Although the Colombian media and perhaps some pundits and observers here from afar in the United States might look at the fact that Iván Duque, the right-wing candidate of the Democratic Center, Centro Democrático, even though he has been looked at as, oh, he's the big winner on Sunday, 39% of the vote, you know, this is the former, the party of the former President Álvaro Uribe Vélez, a very conservative, militarist, strong ally of the U.S. drug war. This is what Iván Duque represents. But if you look at the numbers more closely, the majority of the voters in Colombia voted for left or left of center or centrist parties that essentially reject the Álvaro Uribe program and the Iván Duque program. The second candidate that came in second place, Gustavo Petro, former mayor of Bogota and a former guerrilla of the M19 going back into the 1980s, he received 25% of the vote, so he'll definitely be the runoff candidate against Iván Duque when they square off on June 17th. But the second place finisher, very close to Petro, was Sergio Fajardo, former mayor of Medellin, who describes himself as an anti-corruption crusader and definitely represents a centrist to left of center political position, supported by the Democratic Poll, another left-wing party. He came in close second with 23, almost 24% of the vote. And then if you throw it back into the last place candidate, De La Calle, who was the chief negotiator with the FARC during the peace accords in Havana, as they were being hammered out in Havana, he won about 2%. And now people say, well, that's an indication of a rejection of the traditional parties, which it may be. But if you add those together, we're talking about 52% of the vote, 51% of the vote voting against the Duque experiment and the right wing. So that's something that I think people should be looking at, as opposed to the fact that Duque won 39% of the vote.
And is there an indication that the political figures who came in third and fourth are going to endorse Petro and maybe push him across the finish line? Or is the electorate more independent than that? Are they, do you think that they're open to endorsements of Petro by other candidates?
I think what is, you know, I've been reading some commentary on that, and I think that's the hope, certainly from the left. Again, there's no high expectations given Colombia's long tradition of voting for right-wing candidates and also the very strong base that Álvaro Uribe and Duque have, and how the mainstream media, for the most part, tend to echo a lot of their political perspectives with very little critical thought. And so they have a steep hill to climb to beat Duque in the elections runoff in June. But there is generally a feeling that if Petro and Fajardo in particular get together and hammer out some of their differences, because there are some profound differences between not only Fajardo and Petro, but also some of the people who supported Fajardo during the campaign, particularly the Democratic poll senator Jorge Robledo, who's been a very staunch critic of Gustavo Petro. If there's a way that they can get them all together and create some kind of like a broad front, much reminiscent of what we saw in Uruguay and what we've seen in Chile and other episodes, particularly after the dictatorship, in which you do have to really make some serious concessions to what would traditionally be your opposition or your you know, people who you don't necessarily agree with. If they're able to build that broad front and work things out publicly, there is a possibility that they could move enough of the electorate that is clamoring for a continuation of the peace accords, to try to make sure that the peace accords aren't squashed totally, and to try to move the country forward to a more democratic opening. But that's, as I said, a very steep hill to climb, and it's still too early to tell right now after the elections.
That's the voice of Mario Murillo. Mario is a professor of communications and Latin American studies at Hofstra University. He's covered Colombia for over 25 years. Mario is the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Mario, just help the audience here that won't know that much, certainly. We're in two radio stations here in Washington, D.C., many other stations during the course of the next 24 hours. But most people are not following Colombia. They don't know its history. They don't know the political and social landscape. Talk about the role of the media in Colombia, if you would.
Sure. I mean, I think the Colombian media is pretty diverse. There is a lot of alternative experiments with both online media channels as well as a strong tradition of community radio and community media and alternative publications. But if you look at the mainstream kind of top-down corporate media in Colombia, it's dominated very much. It's based on similar kind of structural and economic patterns that the U.S. mass media have. So although you have a diversity, a kind of a slim diversity of voices on the airwaves, for the most part, they echo kind of the political center and right, and they very often echo the establishment political establishment. So very rarely will you hear indigenous voices or Afro-Colombian leaders or peasantry who have been directly impacted by the war. When people are doing analysis of these elections, for example. Just now, everybody's focusing on the results. Obviously, it's expected given the scope of the first round of elections that just happened, and all the media is focusing on that. And just yesterday, we got news that a Colombian indigenous couple that was from the Nasa people in northern Cauca, in Valle del Cauca, were kidnapped and their bodies were found just yesterday. An indication that the violence and the repression and the targeted assassinations of leaders and the social movements in Colombia continue. And that kind of story doesn't make and it doesn't break through the clutter of the constant, nonstop focusing on the political jockeying that's taking place right now as a result of the elections. And so that's just similar to the U.S. media's fascination with the Russiagate scandal, for example, as opposed to focusing on so many of the other issues that are having an impact on the ground throughout many communities here in the United States. So I think your listeners, I'm sure, understand that, right? They have certain spaces where you can hear these voices, but for the most part, the echo chamber of the establishment, the militarist corporate establishment, is what we hear on a daily basis.
And what's the attitude of the U.S. government? Of course, we have the Trump administration, but beyond Trump or underneath Trump, or behind it, is the sort of permanent government, the State Department professional coterie of diplomats, of course, the Pentagon, the CIA professional, not the appointees who come or go. What's the U.S. establishment, for the lack of a better term, what's its attitude towards the current electoral process in Colombia?
Well, I'm sure, generally speaking, there's probably a hope that Iván Duque, the right-wing candidate, will prevail on the June 17th second round election round, the second round of votes, given his track record as somebody who's been very strongly in favor of U.S. policy in Colombia, embracing a militarist strategy. Of course, he's the kind of underchild of Álvaro Uribe, the former president. But I think it's a complex factor, a number of complex factors that come into play. I was talking to somebody while I was in Barcelona last week at the Latin American Studies Association conference. I was talking to a few people about Colombia, and one person who's in close connection with a lot of kind of policymakers in Washington was telling me how initially when Trump came into office and with the former State Department head Tillerson, there was a real hardcore kind of strong arm kind of position, specifically when it comes to narco trafficking and the issue of cultivations, illicit crop cultivations in the countryside. The numbers of cocoa crops have increased over the last few years, and that's always the fascination and obsession of U.S. policymakers. And there's also concerns about the fact that the peace accords were signed with the FARC, and now the FARC were officially a political party, and that the Colombian government, notwithstanding opening up its that space for the FARC, the U.S. government continues to have the FARC in its list of terrorist organizations. So there was a hard, you know, kind of a lot of pressure being put on the Colombian government of Juan Manuel Santos, that there needed to be a harder line against the FARC. But I think what this person was telling me the other day was that that seems to be kind of a backing off on that position, recognizing that sometimes that's not so favorable. It doesn't mean that they're going to change U.S. policy, that the U.S. policy continues to be fascinated with militarism and with the idea of containing the illicit coca crop without looking at many of the other nuances that take place in the countryside. But I think that at least there's not that heavy duty pressure that we were seeing earlier on in the administration. Doesn't mean it's going to change, but at least that's at least for the time being. I think if Gustavo Petro does, by some odd quirk of political history making, come June, does get elected, we're going to see kind of a strong arm position by the government of the United States. Given that Petro has been branded the Castro Chavista candidate of the left in Colombia, you could imagine what a Trump administration would do if he were indeed to take over the National Palace as the president come August.
We will follow that leading up to the June 17th second round. So we were joined from New York by Mario Murillo. He's professor of communications and Latin American studies at Hofstra University, who has covered Colombia for over 25 years. He's the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Electronic incarceration, the use of ankle bracelets and other monitoring devices on released prisoners, are popular government alternatives to prison. But are they really that different from prison? The devices have turned prisoners' homes into prisons, and in addition, prisoners are charged a daily fee for electronic incarceration. And if they can't pay for it, they go right back. We're joined from Urbana, Illinois by James Kilgore. He's a research scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who also focuses on electronic monitoring and supervision at challengingecarceration.org. He wrote the book Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time, and he spent 6.5 years in federal and state prisons. James, welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. How are you doing today?
Oh, doing well, thanks, James. James, at first glance, the thought of spending time at home when you otherwise would be incarcerated sounds great, but it's actually not so great, is it? Can you explain?
I think that's exactly right. When I've told people in the past that I was doing research on electronic monitoring, having spent a year on a monitor myself, they say, well, what's the problem? It's better than jail. But now that more and more people have experienced electronic monitoring and also the law enforcement folks have polished up their techniques of using it, they've seen that it's actually much more punitive than they ever dreamed. And I think the biggest problem that people face really is that it almost inevitably comes with a regime of house arrest. And you're only allowed out of the house when you have specific permission from a parole or probation officer, and usually then for a very specific amount of time, which creates a lot of stress for people, makes it difficult for them to access employment, medical treatment, to participate in family and community activities. So it becomes a different form of incarceration, but not an alternative to incarceration.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that people don't understand is that there is a lot of responsibility on a recently released prisoner who's under electronic monitoring. If you forget to plug the thing in at night, for example, and recharge it, that could be a violation. And the next thing you know, people are banging on your door wanting to know why the signal went dead. In addition to that, and I think this is more important, there are a lot of people, a lot of poor people, who just simply can't afford to do this. And so their only alternative is to go right back to prison. This is clearly, in my view, discrimination against the poor.
Oh, absolutely. And fees are increasingly being applied. It's not surprising that the two biggest companies in the electronic monitoring industry are BI, which is a subsidiary of the GEO Group, the world's biggest private prison operator, and Securus, which has made millions off of exorbitant prison phone rates. So these are profiteers that have been profiting from the prison industrial complex, and they're looking for ways to recover their costs and make more money out of this technology. So if you don't go back to prison, you can also be just punished by being confined to your house and not being allowed out. I had a communication from a man who was on an electronic monitor. He owed $322 on his bill, and he wasn't allowed out until he paid the bill. I'm not sure what it was he was supposed to do in his house that was going to earn him the money to pay that, but he also had mental health appointments during that time, which they refused to let him out for until he paid the bill.
Man, that actually does not surprise me at all. It's this vicious cycle that many people, especially if they're poor, if they're uneducated, or if they have no job skills, find themselves in. And that's why recidivism rates are very high, and that's why our prisons are full of poor people.
Yeah, it's profit-making, and also for the government, it's a source of revenue, too. Another kind of a way of taxing the poor, taxing the incarcerated, taxing people who have no possible way to fight back, actually, because it's you, the individual, without resources against the omnipotence or seeming omnipotence of the state. How many people are we talking about?
Well, it's difficult to get an exact number. The only real survey that's been done was done by Pew Research in 2015, and they said there was 125,000 devices in operation at the time, plus another 30,000 that are used for people on immigrants. I'm thinking that the numbers are probably closer to 200,000, but the companies don't give out those details, and the way the contracting for electronic monitoring breaks out is you have separate contracts for each state, separate contracts for each county. So trying to piece all that together and get accurate data is pretty difficult.
James, you published a report in 2015 in which you made the point that electronic monitoring should be legally classified as a form of incarceration. To tell you the truth, I didn't know that it wasn't considered to be a form of incarceration until I read your report. Why is it considered to be not incarceration?
Because they don't want it to be. I mean, it's obvious. If you look at it, what the basic condition of incarceration is deprivation of liberty. So if you're not allowed to move out of your house, you're being deprived of your liberty. That's pretty straightforward. But they do all kinds of legal games to differentiate between home detention, home confinement. So they come up with a whole lot of different terms where they manage to not give people credit for time served when they're being locked up. There are some states and some jurisdictions that will grant credit for time served, but the predominant legislation doesn't do that. So when we see a lot of people now who are campaigning for decarceration, particularly in jails and getting people out, reducing or eliminating cash bail, there's a real need to be careful that we don't simply put people out onto electronic monitoring and we haven't really solved the problem. We've simply shifted the site of incarceration from the jail to the community. And once again, there's plenty of instances where people who are on electronic monitors face much of the same kind of pressure that they might face if they were in jail to accept a bad plea bargain. Because if you're under house arrest and you're paying a daily fee and those fees mount up, that's a form of pressure to get you to take a deal. If you're not allowed out of the house to work or to look after your children, then that's a lot of pressure to get that monitor off and take the plea bargain that they offer you.
Indeed. I mean, that's a lot of pressure. People don't think of it this way. First of all, house arrest for most poor people means you're in a small apartment.
That's right.
You're not in some like palatial setting. You're in a small apartment. You can't go anywhere. You can't go outside. If you even step into the hallway, you know, they're going to hit you with that. And you have kids, presumably. You also, in addition to having to work and make sure that nothing that you do, if you can work, if you can finally come to terms with trying to find a job, you can't really work if you're unable to leave home. And even just to get basics like groceries, like food, like supplies. I mean, people just don't, they're not envisioning the kind of pressure and hardship that people will be under those circumstances.
And I think one of the important parts about electronic monitoring is that in most regimes, they don't actually give you specific rules and you don't have entitlements. This is why we came up with these guidelines for electronic monitoring, to try to give people some kind of rights and entitlements when they're on a monitor, because you actually have rights and entitlements when you're in prison. You have so many hours of recreation, so many hours of access to law library, so many hours of visiting and so forth. They may not always be honored, but they do form a basis to contest the practice of the institution. But when you're on a monitor, it's almost entirely left up, in most cases, to the whim of a parole agent or a probation officer. And if you do something they don't like, or, you know, in the case I mentioned before, or if you're behind in your bills, then your movement is likely to be restricted. And I think the other point that you made is that not only are people in small spaces, but these spaces may not be a peaceful place for them to be. The idea is that, you know, the Harvey Weinstein and the Martha Stewart vision of people being on electronic monitoring, where they're just living in comfort with a full refrigerator and acres of a ranch to roam around on. This is not the reality for most people, and in some cases, confining them to their home may be the worst place they could be. If there's violence happening in the house, if there's drugs being used in the house, this may not be the spot for them to be, but they have to be there by law.
We are going to leave it there for the first half of our two-part segment. We were joined from Urbana, Illinois by James Kilgore. He's a research scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who also focuses on electronic monitoring and supervision at challengingecarceration.org. He also wrote the book, Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time, and he spent 6.5 years in federal and state prisons. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health released a study this morning saying that the government's estimate of 64 deaths in Puerto Rico from last year's Hurricane Maria grossly underestimated the true number. The report puts the number of deaths at 4,600, many of them because of delayed medical care. We're joined from New York by Camilo Matos. He's a member of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party. Camilo, welcome back.
Hey, how you doing?
It's great to have you. I have to ask you first for your impressions on these numbers. There's a big, big difference between 64 deaths and 4,600 deaths. What do you attribute this incredible gap to?
The 67, those are, quote unquote, direct deaths from the hurricane, you know, people that the house fell on them or whatever it would be the case. But the other ones are mostly people that were out of neglect. There was a long time, many, many, many weeks had gone by before, even months had gone by before people received medical attention, before they received the food that they needed, before they received the water that they needed. And so, especially those most vulnerable, the elderly, the sick, were left to their own, and many died. I mean, I don't have all the numbers, but those are the reports that I was getting. You know, during the time of the hurricane, we were sending out shipments over there, but we were also getting reports from people on the ground and stuff like that.
You know, interestingly, this study says that the first number that made them realize that something was amiss was just looking at deaths year over year, month by month, showed that 1,052 more people than usual died across the island in the 42 days after the storm. 1,052 more people than otherwise would have been expected to die. So what they did is they went out and they visited more than 3,000 residents across the island. They interviewed the occupants of each house. They reported that 38 people living in their households had died between September 20th, when Hurricane Maria struck, and the end of 2017. So when you convert that into a mortality rate and extrapolate it to the larger population, they came out with this number 4,600. But more importantly, there are other studies that have not been published yet that say that number could be as high as 8,000 people.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, There were medical facilities where people, babies, were incubators, elderly, that was just left. They were left no power, no provisions for where to take them, nothing like that. I would not be surprised if that's the number is a lot higher.
And in fact, that's one of the important points that this study makes. It's a lot of it centers on the lack of electricity. There were a lot of people, because of the lack of electricity, who, for example, couldn't rely on their breathing equipment. There were babies in incubators that died because of a lack of electricity.
Diabetics with no insulin. I remember I got a call because I work as a professional. I work with diabetics and as a health coach. So I got a call from people I know that was like, "Oh, how can I get insulin?" Like, I, you know, that's only something that can be given by a pharmacy, by a doctor. I really didn't know where to refer them. I told them to go out and find a doctor. But, you know, they're in Puerto Rico. They're the people in the mountains. It's difficult to travel. They don't have phones. So you have people that have all these medical conditions that aren't being taken care of.
Yeah, that's right. The report says that 15% of the people interviewed reported that someone in their household was unable to get medicines after the storm, and at least 10% said that they couldn't use their breathing equipment. Fewer than 10% reported closed medical facilities. 6% said doctors were unavailable, and it says here the study estimates, and this to me is one of the most important numbers, that about a third of the deaths were caused by a delay in medical care or the inability to obtain it. So there was no disaster plan in place.
No, there was at all. The military sent their boat, their medical boat, the hospital boat, that's what it's called. They sent it to dock in San Juan, right? And everybody over here knew about it. But there was no way of getting information to the people on the island. They had no information about that. So people weren't actually going to San Juan to get medical care there at the hospital. It was underutilized because that's one of the reasons. The other reason being, you know, gasoline was hard to get, but, you know, come by and many other things. But there was a lack of communication, information in there. There was no plan at all to help the people, especially the people in the mountain areas, which were the people most hit.
The report makes a very important point here, too, that it was done, the researchers did this entire study without the participation of the Puerto Rican government because the Puerto Rican government refused to provide any data to them. Why do you think that would be? What would be in it for the Puerto Rican government to refuse to provide this kind of data?
Because then it will highlight their neglect. It's, you know, is one of their duties is to provide in an emergency like this is to provide, you know, have action plans, make things available. And there were people that were like the citizens themselves were out there roads. They were creating communities and networks among themselves, sharing, making community kitchens. You know, this is what the citizens were doing. The Puerto Ricans over here, we were collecting stuff and sending it out there so that Puerto Rico, you know, the people in Puerto Rico could have stuff. But, you know, there was a part that the government, you know, the one that claims to be the government of Puerto Rico, which is the colonial government from the United States, they have a role to play in, which is to help provide certain things, you know. And they totally didn't do what they were supposed to do.
And what about Puerto Rico today? Tell us what it's like on the island. You know, we were talking on this show just a few weeks ago that that electricity a year later hadn't yet been fully restored. What's the electricity situation like? What about medical care, clean water? Tell us what Puerto Rico's like today.
So there's parts that still don't have electricity, and there's still times when electricity goes away and then they'll come back. There's protest and anger over the government's policy. They are closing down schools. They're not giving work to the electric unions. Their goal is to privatize the electric grid. So there is some, you know, and then a large portion of the population has left Puerto Rico. I think they said 500,000 people have left. There's an island of 3 million people or 3.5 million people. So, you know, 500,000 people leaving is a very large amount.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually, because that was actually one of the study's limitations. They had trouble finding people to interview to make for an appropriate sample. And it's because so many people left the island. They went to Florida. They went to New York. They went wherever they happen to have family on the mainland. And so Puerto Rico has actually been depopulated.
Yes, definitely. And there's no system in place to help bring those people back if they wanted to get back. There's a low unemployment, and every day there's less jobs, you know. With the privatization of schools, there's going to be less kids going to school because they privatized some of the schools, but they're closing a whole bunch of schools. I think the numbers were, if I'm not mistaken, within hundreds, maybe 200 or 300 schools are either closing or being planned to close. So people have moved out, and some people have gone back, but it's hard for more people to go back because, you know, one is that the trauma of being out there and then, you know, being that feeling of helplessness, right? If a disaster comes by and you're not able to get the things that you need to survive, then next season, which is coming around the corner, you might be scared to stay there.
You know, that's really something that nobody's talking about yet. I think most Americans don't realize that hurricane season has already begun. And the island hasn't recovered from last year's storms. This is potentially a disastrous period we're heading into. We're joined from New York by Camilo Matos. He's a member of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party. He joined us to talk about Puerto Rico. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. You can also now hear us at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.